I understand it is now standing room only, so I shall start the event with a warm welcome to all of you for coming here this evening. It is my pleasure to chair this lecture by Howard Davies, director of the LSE, and my co-author on financial reform in the Middle Kingdom. We would also like to thank the LSE Chinese Society for all the great work they put into organizing this event in conjunction with the school. So thank you very much to the students who've been very much involved in that. Howard is director of the LSE. Prior to his current appointment, he was the chairman of the Financial Services Authority, the single regulator for financial services in the UK. And prior to this, Howard has had a list of illustrious appointments, of which I simply highlight in no particular order. Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Director General of the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, and a stint at McKinsey & Company, and Special Advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But I'll have to stop there, otherwise this could go on. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Howard.
Thank you, Linda, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, it should be me really introducing Linda on this topic, because she probably knows more about it than me. And indeed, some of you will probably not know, but one thing that I get, and a few of the senior managers of the school, is a press summary every day. And then every 6 months, we get a review saying, who are the leading LSE spokespeople, you know, who've had most mentions in the press? And you know, you normally expect, as the director, because you're asked to comment on fees or whatever, that you appear there. But actually, for the last two occasions, number one LSE spokesperson has been Linda on China, which kind of shows the interest that there is currently in the British press and the British media in what's going on in China. And indeed, I'm sure the reason that so many people are here this evening is because we have official confirmation this week from the British government that China is an important country, because Gordon Brown at last is making his first visit, which is pretty astonishing, to China this week, which tells you either that the Chinese deal to buy Rover is in big trouble, or that there may now be so many British expatriates in Shanghai and Beijing that it's worth going there in order to solicit their votes. Now, when will the People's Bank revalue the renminbi? Will the Shanghai A-share market sustain its anemic recovery this year or plumb new depths? Will the Bank of China float successfully in Hong Kong in 2005? Will China win more Olympic gold medals than the US in Beijing in 2008? Those are just a few of the questions I do not plan to answer this evening. I do aim, however, to set at least the first three of them in context, because they're all linked to progress in financial sector reform, which is my subject tonight. When he was pressed on the devaluation of the renminbi at the recent G8 meeting in London, Governor Zhao's response was that China needs more time to reform its banking and financial systems to pave the way for reforming the currency policy. So in his mind, that linkage is clear. And most observers would accept that concerns about the quality of corporate governance and regulation are part of the reason for the grim performance of the Chinese stock markets in the last 3 years. So the focus of my remarks this evening is on how well China's financial system is adapted to the needs of a fast-growing economy. In spite of the country's dramatic economic success, indeed perhaps even because of that success, are there underlying weaknesses in the country's financial structure which will need to be corrected if China is to continue on its long and so far uninterrupted 25-year growth path? Also, is China ready to take its proper place in the global financial system? Are its financial institutions ready to compete with those from Western countries as WTO membership brings about significant further opening of the Chinese financial markets to new competitors? Now, to begin to answer these questions, I think we need to step back a little. We need to look first at the shape of the financial system in China by comparison with those of other developed and developing countries. And a study published only last week by McKinsey's Global Institute, was quite an interesting comparison of the depth of financial markets by country. And the calculation they used was a simple financial one, which was total financial assets, bank balance sheets, stocks, bonds, both public and private, as a percentage of GDP. And it occurs to me that in a university context, and I'm sure this is what Linda would do if it was one of her classes, rather than give you the answers, I'm going to ask you what you think. And if you don't answer, there are one or two people whose names I know, and I'll ask them. So if I tell you that in the UK, financial assets as a percentage of GDP are around 400%. The financial system is around 400% of GDP. And if I tell you, just to give you a sighting shot, that India is about 140% of GDP, what percentage is China? What bids do I have? What? 50? Any advance on 50? Any advance on 50? 40. Okay, 45? These are all very narrowly focused. But anyway, I think the consensus in the room, okay, if the UK is 400 and China is 140, what is the Eurozone? We're 400. Any advance on that? 250? 200? Okay. The answer is that the Eurozone, it's 314, and China, it's 323. So, on that measure, China is more financially developed than the Eurozone. And Chinese financial assets have been growing very rapidly, at 14.5% a year over the last decade. And indeed, China now accounts for 4% of the global financial stock. Now, these figures also show, however, that China remains very heavily dependent on bank financing. 62% of all financial assets are in banks. And that is an extraordinarily high percentage by international standards, because in the US it's only 20%, in the UK it's 28%, and even in India it's only 45%. So China, by any standards, even by the standard of a country like India, whose overall financial system is significantly smaller. Yeah?
Are you counting Hong Kong
or China? No. If we look at, I'm not counting it as part of India either, actually, but it's part of the UK still, isn't it? If we look at the equity and bond markets, the differences are even more striking. The capital value of the US market fluctuates around 150% of GDP, while in China it's 30-35%, and of course has been falling in the last couple of years. And the contrast in the bond market is even sharper. In the US, the capital value is around 150% of GDP, while in China it's less than a quarter. And even that may overstate its economic significance for reasons I'll explain. Now, in recent years, China's banking system has continued to grow more rapidly than GDP. Indeed, since 1992, the speed of growth of deposits in the banking system has been higher than the growth of GDP in every year. Last year, when the economy grew by around 9%, domestic bank assets grew by almost 14%. And at the same time, while the bond and equity markets expanded in the 90s, more recently they've fallen back, and attempts by the authorities to promote a revival of the capital markets have so far met with relatively little success. Now, does this matter? After all, the Chinese economy has done very well during this period in which it's been, by international standards, over-reliant on bank financing. Why should that not continue in the future? Well, conventional wisdom in the international financial institutions now strongly favors the development of diverse sources of finance for developing countries. The World Bank offers help to countries to develop their bond markets in particular. Now, in part, that enthusiasm is driven, one has to say, by theory. It makes sense, so the theory goes, for companies to offer a range of financial assets with different risk and return characteristics, better to match the preferences of investors. If they do so, they will, other things being equal, minimize their cost of capital. Also, so it's argued, equity and bond markets are better able to mobilize capital to support projects and companies offering the most attractive returns on investment. They may do so more quickly than banks, which often display evidence of a sunk cost mentality in their investment decisions. In other words, they're often inclined to throw good money after bad in an attempt to rescue earlier unwise loans. Now, what evidence in the specific case of China can we see to support these propositions? Well, perhaps the most powerful piece of evidence comes from the state of the banks themselves. It's now well understood that the major commercial banks have a huge proportion of non-performing loans in their balance sheets. Different commentators offer different estimates on the scale of these bad debts, and they undoubtedly vary from bank to bank, but in spite of recent improvements, external observers like Standard & Poor's estimate that some 35% of the loans in the major Chinese banks are non-performing. The official figures are rather lower, but still large at over 13%. There are definitional differences behind these figures as well as some different degrees of optimism. Some of the worst loans, of course, have been transferred to asset management companies, which are attempting to recover them, though with mixed success so far. Standard & Poor's estimate that a full bailout of the banking system would cost $656 billion, or 43% of Chinese GDP, and that's quite a lot of money in any language. In fact, we misled you slightly at the beginning. The collection was, in fact, for a bailout for the Chinese banking system, not for the LSE's ragweek. When asked in August of last year whether the banking system was solvent in China, Stephen Dunaway, the IMF mission chief, answered simply no. He went on, "The problems aren't solved and more efforts are going to have to be made and additional capital may need to be put in by the government." Now, there are many reasons for this unhappy experience, and it's partly a phenomenon driven by the rapid growth rate, but it also reflects past weaknesses in credit appraisal and the impact of political influence over financing flows. Indeed, for a long time, the large Chinese banks should be seen really as funding channels supporting particular economic sectors than as independent financial institutions seeking a return on capital. It was indeed perhaps a mistake for the Chinese to deem them to be commercial banks when they first emerged from the chrysalis of the People's Bank before implementing more fundamental reforms. Now, these banking system problems are of considerable economic importance. They have consequences for the financial system as a whole. In a recent paper presented to a Harvard seminar, Bei Dugong of the Chinese International Capital Corporation said, "From the angle of finance, the imperfection of the financial system, the underdevelopment of the financial market, and the poorness of financial products make a lot of capital flow abroad and not into places where it can be used effectively. In other words, in comparison with the capability of developed countries to allocate resources effectively, our country still has a long way to go." Now, this phenomenon of capital export is quite a striking feature of the current global financial system. The shallowness of traded asset markets in Asia has been part of the reason for the large outflows of funds from Chinese and other Asian savers into debt elsewhere. Asian countries hold roughly $2 trillion of debt in foreign exchange reserves, mostly in US dollars and euros. And in return, overseas investors put their money into direct and equity investments in Asia. In a paper delivered in Beijing last year at the China Center for Economic Research, Andrew Sheng, the chairman of the Securities and Futures Commission of Hong Kong, characterized this exchange as follows. "With its plentiful cheap labor and natural resources," he said, "Asia, particularly China and India, has emerged as the manufacturing and services subcontractor to the US. In turn, Asia uses the US as its key financial center to manage its risks and allocate back investment. The total equity return swap, where Asia holds debt in the US and in turn the US holds direct investment in Asia, pays the US financial sector roughly an 8 to 11% premium for better risk management skills, this being the difference in return on foreign direct investment of 12 to 15% a year, and the long-term return on US treasuries of 4% a year. So this financial swap is costing Chinese savers very dear." Sheng sees other problems too in the Asian financial system. The concentration of savings in the banking system has benefited inefficient borrowers at the expense of savers. Bank credit risk has not been properly priced, with bank spreads of 1.5 to 2%, when non-performing loans are, as I've said, probably around 30% of total assets. This means banks cannot have been pricing risk properly. At the national level, an excessive concentration of risk in the banking system is also unwise for macroeconomic reasons. It means that unexpected economic shocks reverberate strongly through the banking system. The Asian financial crisis of the late 90s showed this risk in a dramatic way. Because of the vulnerability of bank balance sheets, which were heavily exposed to FX risk on top of credit risk, what might have been a sharp but manageable adjustment was turned into a wholesale financial collapse. Lastly, Sheng points out that excessive reliance on bank finance tends to work against the promotion of strong corporate governance standards. In many parts of Asia, he says, the protection of domestic interests, such as the legal and accounting professions, as well as restricted entry of foreign financial institutions, has delayed corporate governance reforms. Now, Sheng believes that all these arguments point towards the need for fundamental reform. And furthermore, he sees strong demographic and political arguments in favour. When you are a young economy, he says, you care more about growth than capital income preservation. However, as the Asian population begins to reach middle age, financial systems will have to be more responsive to the needs of an aging population. And that is certainly beginning to happen in China. Richard Jackson and Neil Howe have written about this problem in a book called The Greying of the Middle Kingdom, which points to the need in China for rapid development of formal retirement provision to support growing numbers of older people who lack family support. Why is this a relevant point in relation to the banking system? Well, because, to quote Sheng one last time, the high costs of bank restructuring in Asia mean that there is either an unfunded fiscal deficit or large holes in retirement funds, which were used to finance the rescue of failed corporations and in meeting fiscal deficits. Given low yields in bonds and equity, there's a serious risk that current mispricing of risks means that future retiring generations may have to bear the cost of the current generation's policy mistakes. Now, taken together, these arguments present a powerful case for reform. The authorities, and particularly Chairman Liu Mingkang of the China Banking Regulatory Commission, are well aware of it. But of course, reform is not easy. In any country, reforms run up against vested interests, and financial system reform is frequently very expensive. The scale of losses in the banking system in China means that there's only one possible source of adequate funding to restore the vitality of banks' balance sheets, and that's the government. And I have yet to find a country where providing financial support to a struggling banking system is a politically popular move. Bankers are never very attractive sources of, very attractive destinations for charitable finance, particularly if they're seen to have been at least partly the architects of their own misfortunes. The political problem of that kind bedeviled attempts to resolve the Japanese financial crisis for more than a decade. Now, while in China political pressures do not present themselves in quite the same way as they do in a parliamentary democracy, they are nonetheless real. China has already provided support of some $50 billion to recapitalize its two strongest banks and prepare them for stock market listing. And that's an indication of the scale of the problem. Even in China, $50 billion is not small change. But sometimes unpopular measures have to be taken for the public good. So having spelt out the problem in some detail, what menu of solutions can I offer? Well, a fully comprehensive financial reform program is well beyond the scope of today's lecture, but I will spell out some suggestions in four areas. First, the banking system. Well, as I've said, the need for reform there is well understood by the Chinese authorities, and a lot has been done already. Bad debts have been transferred to the asset management companies, capital injections have been introduced, and some important management restructuring. And as a result, two of the banks, Bank of China and China Construction, have now been upgraded by Standard & Poor's to investment grade, and that's, I think, to the credit of the CBRC. But it's clear that more needs to be done, and that will almost certainly involve further injections of capital, as it's unlikely that all the major banks will be able to meet international capital standards through their own efforts. And if they're going to be prepared for flotation on the stock market, a move which I support, then they will need to present more acceptable balance sheets to prospective investors, whether from China or elsewhere. But most importantly, the market needs some confidence that the banks will not get themselves back into the distressed position they found themselves in. Can we be sure the authorities are not throwing good money after bad? Have new credit appraisal techniques been built into the banking system? Have the banks established the appropriate degree of distance between them and their customers, which is an essential feature of a proper banking system? Is political lending a thing of the past? Well, I doubt we can yet answer yes to these questions. The financial system is still too intertwined for my taste, with bank officials, regulators, and central bankers exchanging positions from time to time as if they remain part of the same organization, which of course they all originally were as part of the People's Bank Network. There needs to be more creative tension between banks, their customers, and their regulators. Creative tension underpins banking systems in developed economies and ensures that a degree of challenge is built into the system of allocating credit. It is, of course, a major cultural change to switch from a process of credit allocation based on quotas and political judgments to one based on the projected profitability of new companies and new investments. But if that new credit culture is to be created, there will also be a need for greater flexibility in interest rate setting. At the moment, under the People's Bank control, the spreads in China are far too narrow to reflect differences in credit risk in different borrowers. And without that flexibility, banks will find it difficult to introduce a new credit appraisal system. Banks need strong internal audit systems too. Bill Rhodes, the senior vice chairman of Citigroup, argued in the Financial Times in January that these internal auditors should report directly to the board of directors. That doesn't typically happen now. And there's also, and he said, a need to invest heavily in training and development of staff at all levels. And indeed, he made a number of other suggestions for change, all of which make good sense to me. Now, it should be said that alongside a properly commercial system, and there are clearly concerns in China about moving the banks to a more commercial approach, there will remain a role for development funding. And indeed, even in countries like the UK, there are still funding mechanisms through regional development agencies and others within a framework agreed in the European Union to devote funds to worthy projects which might not otherwise be supported. But these funding arrangements are managed separately from the commercial banking system, and they are not allowed to corrupt the normal processes of credit appraisal and credit allocation in profit-seeking institutions. And I think that China needs to have a parallel system over time, and not to mix up development funding with banks that are then also supposed to be commercial and supposed to compete with foreign institutions. If China's commercial banks are to become internationally competitive, they need to face more competition at home. WTO membership will require further domestic opening, and that process is underway. At the end of last year, the CBRC opened up 5 more cities to international competition and relaxed some other constraints on foreign branches. But I think more liberalisation is still needed. Lastly, in relation to the banking system, in the last few years there have been too many accidents involving unauthorised credit approvals and sometimes straightforward fraud. Some of these cases have been well publicised, an example to others, and stringent penalties imposed, but it's clear that further efforts need to be made to guard against fraud and corruption in the future. Only last month, the Bank of China revealed another $100 million fraud in Harbin, and the CBRC itself said the case exposed problems with lax internal management, non-enforcement of rules, non-investigation of violations, and light punishments. Now, the long-term aim of the Chinese authorities is clear. They want to see strong, well-capitalized banks operating with the discipline of external shareholders. Liu Mingkang said recently that the sector is getting healthier and stronger and forecast that 21 banks would meet international standards by the end of the year. But the road ahead is still a difficult and bumpy one, and great determination will be needed by the regulators. In a sense, the banking system is where the problems and the side effects of a long period of very rapid economic development end up. China's economic performance has been outstandingly successful, but no economy can grow at 8% a year for 25 years without some casualties and accidents along the way, without some projects which didn't deliver a return or companies which went bankrupt. And the financial impact of those problems has drifted into the banking system and hasn't been fully recognised in the public accounts. So in overhauling the banks, the authorities are in effect coping with the side effects of the boom. Finally, as far as the banking sector is concerned, is the state of the banking system the principal obstacle to introducing exchange rate flexibility, as Governor Zhao suggests? Well, the IMF don't think so. Stephen Dunaway said last August, "We don't feel that strengthening the banking system is a precondition to increasing the flexibility in the exchange rate." He went on, "There's not a substantial threat to the banking system of substantial movements of funds out of Chinese banks into alternative investments." And in spite of the weakness described, I suspect he's right. Now, the second area where further reform is needed is in the development of Chinese capital markets. As I've explained, both equity and bond markets in China are relatively small. While there has been some growth, and last year 133 companies issued new shares or bonds, the total of new issuance was only 86 billion renminbi, just 5% up on the previous year. So growth well below the growth rate in the economy as a whole at a time when you would hope that the equity and bond markets would be growing more rapidly than the economy. The expansion of these markets would create a more diverse financial market and a more robust basis for the next phase in the expansion of the economy. And experience shows that in most countries there is a reasonable correlation between the state of economic development and the size of its capital markets. So what reforms are necessary to allow further progress to be made? Well, I think the answers are slightly different in relation to debt and equity, and let's take equity first. In a survey of business in China published in March of last year, The Economist issued a damning verdict on the Chinese stock market. Chinese equity investment has been very disappointing in recent years, with both the Shanghai and Shenzhen markets in decline. According to The Economist, I quote, much of the decline can be attributed to a massive share overhang. The government still owns 2/3 of the equity in the country's listed firms, and its periodic attempts to sell, or rumours it may do so, depress prices. On top of that, the market is rigged by the securities industry, made up of 130 largely corrupt brokers, most of which are trying to stave off bankruptcy, having promised investors guaranteed returns they now cannot honour. But the biggest problem is the poor quality of the listed companies. This is a serious catalogue of problems. The Economist, using its trademark blunt language, may be exaggerating to make a point, but the general problem is well understood by the CSRC. And they've begun to take a more active approach to disciplining companies which misstate their profits and to dealing with corruption and mismanagement in securities companies. All these are necessary steps, and they need to be pursued with vigour and consistency. As Chengang Xu of the Department of Economics here and his co-author Katharina Pistor point out, enforcement capacity at the exchange has been increased, at the agency has been increased, and courts have bowed to pressure to allow investor lawsuits. But as they say, China still faces a major challenge to transform its market governance structure from one based on quotas and administrative direction to one based on law and individual property rights. Now, there are other necessary measures too. The market needs to be open to greater competition. The government needs to explain how it plans to sell its equity holdings. In the long run, investors should be allowed even access to stocks, whether they're based in China or overseas. Securities themselves need to be, securities firms themselves need to be better capitalized. Many are now effectively bankrupt. One promising route is to liberalize the rules governing foreign participation in the securities business in China. The decision to grant Goldman Sachs approval for a large investment in a Chinese securities firm recently is a positive step. Another positive move is yesterday's announcement, reported in today's Financial Times, by the CSRC of the creation of a fund to protect investors in bankrupt brokerages backed by public money. That should make it easier to close down firms who have no future in the industry. There are important decisions to be made, too, about the degree to which banks may be allowed to operate in securities markets. I suspect that over time we may see Chinese securities companies become parts of broader financial groupings in China or parts of broader international financial institutions. This may give some additional solidity and stability to the equity markets themselves. But, of course, the vitality of equity markets depends fundamentally on the quality of listed companies, which in turn depends on rigorous enforcement of property rights and high-quality corporate governance. So over time, the development of the market will be driven by investors' perceptions of corporate governance and by their confidence in the stewardship of their investments. At present, minority shareholders perceive that companies offer too little in the way of protection of their interests and too little transparency. As far as the bond market is concerned, the bond market has apparently grown quite rapidly, and far more bond finance has been raised than new equity investment. The interbank bond market has developed rapidly. According to the China Development Bank, transactions in 2002 were over 450 times as large as in 97. But most of this new issuance and most of the secondary market turnover has been in public sector bonds. The corporate bond market is still small, and private bonds apparently make up 5% of the financial stock, but most of the corporate bonds in issue are effectively guaranteed by one state agency or another. There's relatively little secondary market trading. Most investors buy and hold. Indeed, most of the bonds in issue are held by the banks. As a result, the bond market is not playing its full role in economic development. If it is to do so, then a number of reforms are necessary. Some of them are quite detailed. There's a need, for example, for efficient and transparent pricing benchmarks. There's a strong argument for independent rating agencies. In developed countries, rating agencies play a very significant role in providing some comfort for investors. In addition, they act as a further stimulus over and above that provided by the regulators for the promotion of transparency and disclosure. With some kind of rating structure, it will be possible to envisage listing non-guaranteed bonds to encourage the introduction of credit discipline in the market. Bond markets in the developed world also benefit significantly from the existence of liquid secondary markets and repo markets, which allow short selling. There is also a range of derivative products which create greater liquidity and allow credit risk to be packaged and repackaged to suit the preferences of investors. And there are instruments, notably interest rate swaps, which facilitate hedging. Now, some of the features of the debt market in New York and London may not be easy to replicate quickly in China, but it is important to develop a strategy to introduce reforms and liberalisation over a period. The British government is currently financing a study of how derivatives markets might best be introduced. The Chinese authorities have in many areas demonstrated their willingness and ability to take a long and strategic view, and this is another area of policy in which such an approach is necessary. My own view is that the development of a more liquid and vital bond market is well within China's capacity. Now, thirdly, corporate governance has become one of the world's fastest growing industries in the last few years. Now, it's long been understood there's a relationship between corporate governance, investor protection, and the vitality of capital markets, and the collapses of Enron and other companies in the US and Parmalat in Italy has given added impetus to pressures for reform in developed countries. Now, the details vary from country to country, but the general principles of good corporate governance are now reasonably well understood. There's common agreement on the need for independent directors. Indeed, it's almost universally agreed those independent directors should be in a majority, particularly in large companies. It's also almost universally agreed that companies should be transparent about the way in which their directors are remunerated and about the financial relationships they may have with the company. Those independent directors must act in the interests of shareholders and not of the management, and there should be a channel of communication between investors and independent directors. Now, these principles are more difficult to apply in the case of state-owned enterprises, but the general theory behind them remains valid. Indeed, the CSRC has issued a corporate governance code for application by Chinese companies. In fact, in my previous job, I participated in its launch in Beijing. And we know in the UK that there can be a considerable distance between the issuance of a code and its implementation. And there is certainly still a long way to go in China. And I suspect that full implementation will not occur until there's greater pressure from, for example, ratings agencies and indeed overseas investors. And so once again, reform and openness of the market are intimately linked. Now, my fourth and last subject area is financial regulation. And you might expect me as a former regulator to put this first, but I deliberately leave the subject to the end because I see the key role of regulators as being to monitor and police developments in markets and not necessarily to lead those developments. In China, the regulators have been put into the position of leading to a greater extent than would be normal in developed countries. In the UK, codes of corporate governance have been written by companies themselves and then endorsed and monitored by the regulator. In China, the process is clearly the other way around. Over time, it should be the regulator's ambition to step back, but it may be a little while before that ambition can be realized. The Chinese authorities have adapted and developed their regulatory institutions over the last few years. In the UK, of course, we have one regulator, the FSA, and I regard that as a desirable long-term model. But at the present state of development in China, with legal restrictions on cross-sectoral alliances, an approach built on three independent commissions, the CBRC, the CSRC, and the CIRC, the China Insurance Regulatory Commission, makes good sense. And I particularly approve of the separation between banking regulation and monetary policy, a model increasingly adopted around the world, though not yet in the United States or France, who remain allies in this area, if no other. The Chinese have borrowed extensively from the UK in this area. The recent new banking law owes a lot to the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. Indeed, the first two or three clauses of it are more or less a translation. Now, I do not have time today to review in any detail the way in which Chinese regulations developed and needs to evolve in the future, but I'll just make one point. In the last 5 years, since the creation of the Global Financial Stability Forum in 1999 following the Asian crisis, the pace of change in international financial regulation has accelerated sharply. In the past, the international groupings, the Basel Committee, IOSCO, etc., developed essentially voluntary codes. Countries could choose whether or not to implement them. In the case of the Basel Accord, it was theoretically the case that banks could not operate internationally without meeting the requirement for 8% capital, but there was no effective policing of the quality of regulation, or indeed the quality of capital in individual countries. And we now know that banks from some countries, notably Japan, did continue to operate internationally without meeting the standard. In the last few years, the policing of international standards has been significantly strengthened. While in theory they remain voluntary, in practice that's now scarcely the case. The IMF have set up a department which carries out financial sector assessment programs looking at the extent to which an individual country is meeting these international standards. I'm well aware of the seriousness of this initiative since the An FSAP, as they're called, was carried out in the UK while I was chairman of the FSA. 30 people turned up and spent weeks in our offices doing it. So far, no formal conditionality is attached to these assessments, but the results of them influence the views of the IMF and the World Bank. They know from the Asian financial crisis of the late 90s that poor quality regulation of financial systems can contribute to economic collapse. So any country must now appreciate that the quality of its financial regulation will be put under the international microscope. And the Chinese authorities have understood that point very well, and it's one reason why they've established international advisory councils to help them develop standards and practices which meet international requirements. As I've explained, there's a lot of further progress to be made, but the direction of change is clear. And I've been privileged to be allowed to take part in this process as a member of the advisory councils of both the CBRC and the CSRC. The forward agenda is very challenging. There's a shortage of technical and indeed interpersonal skills needed for effective regulation. I emphasized earlier the need for challenge between regulators and financial institutions, and there's very little tradition of that in China. And that it's difficult to develop those skills in developed markets as well, but particularly in developing countries. So one needs to be realistic about the extent to which countries can meet international best practice in every respect, and indeed I've argued elsewhere that some of the international standards are perhaps excessively detailed and complicated and not fully adapted to the needs of emerging markets. So, in conclusion, let me reformulate the questions I posed at the outset. Are there weaknesses in the Chinese financial system which still need to be corrected? Are Chinese financial institutions ready to compete with international firms? Does China yet have the financial system which it will need in the next phase of its development? Now, a very simplified summary of what I've said so far would conclude that the answers I've given to these three questions were in each case no. But just as is the case in the LSE, this is not a simple pass-fail examination. So a fairer summary would be to say that further progress is needed in all areas. There are considerable obstacles still to be overcome, but in my view, the direction of change is the right one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Howard, for a wonderful speech full of insight. And I think my degree of optimism has now been increased with your appointment to the International Advisory Committees for the CBRC and the CSRC. And certainly every indication that I have heard from international investors has certainly supported that. So thank you very much. Howard has agreed to take questions. So if I might invite questions from the audience. In fact, Chen Gangxu will be the first. There is a roving microphone which is coming around.
If we compare the Chinese banking system with the UK or the United States or whatever Western countries, then the biggest difference is that the Chinese banking system is highly concentrated in a few large banks, and all of these large banks are state-owned. So I'd like to know your views on the pros and cons of eliminating the entry barriers for the private institutions entering the banking system.
Well, actually, in relation to the UK, the degree of concentration is not so different, actually. I mean, there are only really seven or eight banks in this country that between them hold certainly 90% of the retail deposits in this country. So we live with a fairly concentrated system. I think that the differences are, of course, that traditionally the Chinese banks, which were organized on this sectoral basis, with the Bank of China focusing on external trade, the Agricultural Bank focusing on agriculture, industrial and commercial, focusing on businesses and China construction, on project finance largely, were barely competing with each other at all. And certainly not for lending. I mean, the lending was organized into these different sectors. So there is far less competition, even though there is about the same degree of concentration, if you like. And I think that
Chinese authorities need to introduce greater competition between their banks, as well as in allowing other banks to establish themselves in China. But as I've said briefly, but perhaps I should have emphasized this point a bit more, unless you allow greater interest rate flexibility, the competition is a little bit forced in the sense, because you are not really competing on credit decisions and good investment appraisals, if you like, which is supposedly the competitive advantage of banks in certainly in business banking. So I think you need to allow wider interest rate spreads in order to make competition between banks meaningful. Also, in terms of market opening, the Chinese authorities have been quite slow, and they allowed foreign banks in, but they would not allow them, for the most part, to do renminbi business. I mean, they would allow them to come in and lend in dollars, but not, in fact, to take renminbi deposits or to lend in renminbi. So that meant that the competition was really focused on a pretty narrow part of the market of the purely exporting business in the big cities. And there were also, well, there still are constraints on what you can do with a branch. The Chinese find it amazing that here, if you allow a bank in, then they can establish as many branches as they want. Whereas in China, it's approval on a branch-by-branch basis. You know, if you have a branch on one street corner, you can't have another one on the next street corner. You have to go through another approval process to do that. So the process of market opening has really been quite slow so far. And I guess influenced by the fact that their perception was that their own banks would find it extremely difficult to compete if they allowed more competition. Now, as in many industries and in many countries, the issue is the speed of change. I don't find when I go to China now that there's anyone really arguing about the fact that it would be better to have more competition in the banking system. The question is, how do you phase that to match the process of reform within the banks themselves? And the banks themselves say, well, no, we don't necessarily mind having more competition, but of course, if so, we would need to be able to improve our cost base, and that improving our cost base means that we will have to lay people off. Because the banks have got huge numbers of staff. I mean, millions they employ, and they have not been allowed to remove those staff in order to make themselves more competitive. So there is a kind of complicated circle of argument where the government says, you banks, you know, you must be more competitive or else you won't be able to meet foreign competition. And they say, well, hang on, we'd love to be more competitive and meet foreign competition, but you won't allow us to lay off our staff, particularly not in Western China or whatever. And so this is quite a complicated picture. And the issue is really the pace of change. So there's not an issue of principle, I find, in China. It's the issue of the pace of change. And I guess from outside, you're more or less inevitably disposed to think that things could move more quickly and that you would get the benefits of competition more rapidly if you allowed more entry by foreign institutions. So that's what I tend to argue, though I hope I'm alive to the domestic political difficulties of that.
We'll take this question first. I think there's a mic somewhere over there. Could I also ask you to introduce yourself before you ask your question?
Shirley from LSE, a student here. Can you elaborate a bit more on why you think good banking reform is not a prerequisite to the liberalizations of renminbi or the floating of renminbi?
Well, the question, it's not obvious, first of all, what the impact of the floating of the renminbi would be. I mean, people tend to assume it will go upwards, but I don't think we absolutely know that. So it's quite difficult to know on what basis the assertion is made that there would be a great problem for the Chinese banks. And also, I think that the Chinese banks have not, to my knowledge, undertaken the kind of unhedged foreign currency borrowing that was a feature of say, Thailand or Indonesia before the Asian banking crisis. And it's that problem, obviously, that could affect the banks if they had significant mismatched foreign exchange positions. And it's not clear to me that they do have a large foreign currency mismatch. And therefore, it's not clear to me why they would lose out so considerably on a flotation of the renminbi. Now, you know, that's not to say that there aren't arguments against doing it, and I mean, I have to say, I'm certainly not among those who are shouting aggressively at the Chinese authorities that they must float the renminbi. I mean, I think that their policy of saying, yes, we plan to do it in due course and, you know, gradually working towards it makes sense. But I honestly am not sure that it's really the banking system that is the prime obstacle. I think it's worries overall about the overall competitiveness of manufacturing industry that is the bigger factor than the worries, the particular worries of a currency mismatch in the banks.
Question in the front.
You had mentioned the...
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. My name is Terry. I'm an LSE student here. You had mentioned the study of derivatives markets in China. And I'm curious as to your opinion. Do you think that the Chinese government would allow the same degree of financial engineering in China that took place in, you know, in the West in the 90s?
Well, there's some big assumptions in there about what kind of financial engineering you don't like. I think that they will look at the introduction of derivatives markets primarily as a way of allowing hedging and risk diversification rather than as a way of allowing speculation. Now, of course, as soon as you say that, you say, well, how do you distinguish the one from the other? And that can be quite difficult. But I suspect that they will be very keen to monitor leverage ratios in investment funds, etc., because I think they recognize that the use of bond derivatives could be dangerous in the wrong hands. So I would expect, if they go in that direction, and then no decision has been made about derivatives, but as our study is being done to look at technically how it would be achieved in China, that they will be pretty cautious on leverage. And they will try to see that as being just a way of people hedging interest rate exposure.
Question in the back.
Oh, well, thank you for your prescription for China's financial markets reform. But I have two questions. Number one is about the capital market. You mentioned that the equity market is pretty underperformed in the past years because lack of confidence of market, because there is kind of adverse selection by the market, so that all the companies who are listed turn out to be very bad at the end. So what do you think is a key point to restore market confidence, especially what should Chinese government do in solving the problem, like the segregation of shareholding problem, like the same share but different rights to the share? And the second question is, you just mentioned that if China could introduce more foreign banks in market competition, that would greatly help Chinese financial market reform. But there is also a point of view that just like what we have seen in Argentina, even those multinational banks come in, they would only do those very good business like cherry picking, and they will not lend to those small or middle enterprises, or they will not consider much about consumer credit, like for personal clients. So, because they are quite sensitive to return and cost control and such kind of thing. So, what do you think of this kind of view?
On the first point, I think that the key is the issue of property rights. and particularly the position of minority shareholders. Now, Andrew Sheng of Hong Kong has done a lot more thinking about this, a lot more work on this than I have, but that is certainly his prescription, that at the moment one of the great anxieties that shareholders have is that the rights of minority shareholders are not well protected in China. And there have been examples of corporate collapses and minority shareholders being left with absolutely nothing, even though there were assets left in the company. And I think that from the point of view of external shareholders, it's the concern about transparency and protection of minority shareholders. Now, that's property rights, but it also is corporate governance and independent directors with a clear duty to follow the interests of shareholders rather than management, and some cases which are brought against independent directors who have not done that, which would be required, I think, to create that kind of market discipline. And now, on your second point, as it happens, maybe you chose an unfortunate example from your point of view, because I'm sure you know more about China than I do, but actually I know quite a lot about Argentina, and what you said about Argentina is not right at all. Indeed, I was down in Argentina last year and asked to go and advise them about trying to recover from their financial crisis. But in fact, in general, there isn't normally an issue about consumer finance by foreign institutions. I mean, foreign institutions were very active in consumer finance in Argentina, largely for the very good reason that actually consumer lending, as long as you're big enough, is considerably less risky than business lending. I mean, just as a fact. Consumers typically have got assets and you can get their houses and whatever. I mean, consumer lending is simply less risky, which is why under the new Basel Accord there will be less capital required to hold consumers. So I don't think you need to worry about the foreign banks not wanting to do consumer business. It is true that foreign banks will be nervous about small to medium enterprises lending. Now, why will they be concerned about it? They're concerned about it for two or three reasons. One, because unless you're really big, it's actually very difficult to get into the SME market in a new country. And we don't need to look at China for that example, we need to look at the UK. In fact, you may have seen there's been articles in the last couple of days by someone called Don Cruikshank, who wrote a review about banking here, who argued that there was a complex monopoly in the UK on small business finance. And in fact, he's probably right to some degree. I mean, it's actually been almost impossible for foreign banks to penetrate the UK small business market because the local banks know too much about those companies. And foreign banks coming in fear that the ones who will be available to them will be precisely the worst credit risk. And they're the ones that the local banks are not looking after properly. So there is a problem about foreign banks dealing with small and medium enterprises. And I suspect that there are very few foreign banks at the moment who are dreaming of getting into the Chinese small finance market. I just don't believe that's going to be their main interest. They'd love to get at some of the big Chinese exporters or the wealthy middle class in Shanghai and lend them mortgages and consumer credit and stuff. That's what they want to do. They don't want to do SME finance. So I don't think you need to worry about them competing unreasonably in that market. But your question, I think I tried to address by saying that it may well be that for policy reasons and for regional development reasons, you wish to have cheap finance available for small firms, particularly in some areas. I mean, you might well want to do that in Western China. You might well perhaps not want to do that in Shanghai. But if you do that, if you do want to, you have to recognize that that is a different policy objective. And you can't rely on banks who are having to produce a return to shareholders doing that business out of the goodness of their heart. And you can look in this country, there have been a whole variety of small business lending schemes, guaranteed interest rates by the Department of Trade and Industry. The Germans have got a big thing called KfW, which has been the big funding channel for small firms, which is explicitly constructed, separate from the commercial banking system, with government support built into it so that it can offer discounted interest rates. Now, in this country, we've tended even to move away from that, actually, because we're not confident that non-commercial banks actually make particularly good lending choices. But nonetheless, it is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and they do it in the States. You know, there's the Small Business, what do they call the
Small Business Bureau.
The Small Business Bureau and the SBSA, or whatever it's called, which provides subsidized lending to small firms. But country after country has recognized that if you mix that up with a commercial bank, you get real problems, because then you get non-performing loans left in the commercial bank, someone's got to bail out that. Managing an operation where you know that a part of what you're doing is commercial and a part of it's deliberately not commercial is a bad idea. That you should be explicit about your support for small businesses, if that's what you want to do. Acknowledge that it has a public expenditure cost. Don't try and pretend it doesn't by hiding it in the banking system and then eventually having to bail out the banks with some huge amount of money. And that's been a lesson that, you know, many countries have rather painfully learnt, and China is the most recent one.
There's quite a lot of hands up, and so could I ask the people who are asking questions to introduce themselves and try to keep your questions concise so we could get to as many of these as possible. I'm going to sort of hop over to that side of the room for the moment. Could you, and there's a mic coming your way. Thank you.
My name is Jinyan Zhang, China Economic Daily. My question for Director Howard Davis is, last year, 2004, China witnessed extraordinary increase of foreign currency reserve. It has a net increase of $200 billion. So what is your view of what are the factors that leading to such a huge increase of foreign currency reserve? What advice you will provide with the Chinese government to deal with such a situation? Because many hot money is betting on the appreciation of Chinese renminbi.
Yeah. Well, I think that most of the arguments about that are relatively well understood. The contribution I tried to make to that debate this evening was to point out that holding this amount of reserves in dollars and investing it in US treasuries is quite a costly hobby to have, because effectively, as I tried to explain, there is a sort of total debt equity swap going on here, with the Chinese owning low returning US debt and US investors building up equity stakes and direct investment in China, which is earning a higher return. And so there is a cost to be taken into account, a financial cost of this mismatch, to be set alongside the risk, which clearly the Chinese authorities perceive, of currency liberalization and the risk of damaging competitiveness. So it isn't just sitting where you are with a fixed renminbi dollar rate is not costless, and the cost is actually going up every year because of this debt equity swap that I've described. Now, my own prejudice, and I have to say it's no more than that, and it comes from bitter experience in the UK Treasury and the Bank of England, is that fixed exchange rates, in the end, are a terrible problem. Almost it's kind of engraved in my heart to believe in variable exchange rates. Which is not to say I'm in favor of the euro, because that's no exchange rate. You know, that's once you've got one currency, you're fine. In fact, I just find fixed exchange rates very difficult because they create imbalances, pressures build up, and the longer you go on, the more difficult it is to unwind it, because the more worried you are about the consequences of unwinding. So, you know, I have to say I can't be other than in favour of more flexible exchange rates, and I can't help thinking that that's where China will go. And this build-up, as you describe, is a sort of build-up of pressure, which I think will go on and on unless something is done to release that pressure.
There's quite a lot of questions, and shall we aim, would you agree, Howard, to aim to end in about 10 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Try to take as many of these as we can. So we shall start just right in the back there. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Svenja Schlichting. I'm a PhD student from Germany, and I have two questions. The first one regards your job as international financial advisor of the financial regulatory bodies. What would you say, in your opinion, how important is the international advice to the shape of the emerging regulatory system in China? And the second question is, how would you characterize the regulatory regime that is emerging? Is it moving into the direction of a very liberal market economy, or is it moving more into the direction of with more interventionist government methods, maybe in the mode that we've seen in other Asian countries? Thank you.
Shall we take a couple of more questions, sure. Howard, and gather them? Just down that row, is fine.
My name is Zhang Jia, I'm from BBC. My question is that everybody knows Chinese government injected $45 billion into two large state-owned banks at the end of year 2003. Do you think it is a legitimate step, because there are people saying that this step should have been approved by the National People's Congress before the government could do that? Thank you.
Okay, one more, I think. Just there,
Hi, UK regulators tend to follow a relatively more free market-oriented approach, and what top tips and biggest lessons you'd like to share with Chinese regulators in regulating banking system? Thanks.
Thank you. Well, let me try and deal with those as quickly as I can. On the first point about the sort of international influence, the Chinese have, I think, taken a very sensible approach recently in looking in a very careful way at overseas models and importing as much of them as is sensible to import, rather than trying to build everything up from scratch. So, for example, as I mentioned, their latest bank, UK's Financial Services and Markets Act, they imported financial regulators from Hong Kong, from the Hong Kong Securities Futures Commission, to advise them on securities law in China, and building on a kind of UK-Hong Kong model, which I think is a sensible way for them to go, particularly given the, you know, the extensive importance of Hong Kong as a sort of window for China on the global financial markets. I think that's been a very sensible approach, and with the financial advisors, international advisors, they use us, I think, very effectively with quite specific questions about how they should meet international financial standards. As for the direction of change, I think that it is generally in the direction of a more liberal and open markets. And if you look at the changes that the CBRC have made in particular over the last 2 or 3 years, it may be slow, and I may say it should be quicker, but actually it is about market opening. You know, each 6 months or so, a few more banks are allowed in and into a few more cities. And the commitment to float at least two of the banks has very extensive long-term consequences. If you want to have float those banks and have external shareholders in them, that imposes a very significant check and balance on you in the future. Because if you float Bank of China and Construction Bank in Hong Kong and have large-scale overseas investors in there, then if you turn back to protect your domestic banks or constrain those banks, then you're going to have a lot of trouble with international markets. Once you've done that, you know, you raise the stakes for yourself quite considerably. I'm afraid that I'm going to duck the political question about whether it should have gone to the Chinese People's Congress. I can't say I'm an expert. Linda may be a member of the People's Congress. Are you by now? I don't know. But elected by the overseas Chinese constituency. But I honestly wouldn't. I'd prefer not to comment on that. I'm sorry. As far as the advice from UK regulators are concerned, I mean, the key thing that I believe very strongly is in as much transparency in regulation as possible. And that if you're a regulator and you try to resolve problems yourself in private dealing with financial institutions, they often can be extremely difficult. And the more you can disclose of the financial position of firms and allow the market pressures to intrude and the market to make choices, the better. And so the more disclosure of your regulation, the better. The Chinese are getting quite good at that. I mean, there is much more codified regulation now than there was in the past. You know, there is much more that's clear about what the rules are. What they haven't yet done is consultation, which is a normal part of the procedure in the SEC, for example, or in the FSA, where you'd put out a draft and say, this is what we are thinking of doing. How do you, you know, do you think that makes sense? Is this the best way to do it? And I think that over time, they should move towards that kind of approach. But frankly, if they did, they'd be ahead of continental Europe, because they, you know, the Germans never do that. So, nor do the French. So I think that's quite extreme. But I think they are moving in that direction.
There's a question in the back there, and then we'll take, sorry, I sort of saw a hand go up.
Hi, Yet He, MSC Accounting and Finance. In recent years, the LSE has been a popular destination for a lot of Chinese students. Now, in your role as the director of the LSE and also economic advisor to the Chinese government, what are some words of advice for current students here who, in the next 10, 15 years, will be leading a lot of the reforms that you've mentioned just now?
Work hard. Don't go to the bar. I mean, I think that the best thing I could say would be that you should try to take advantage of your time here to get as much knowledge of the way Western institutions also work, as well as just what you're learning in on your courses. And we try at the school to offer options. I mean, there are internship things, and we try to offer familiarization with the way Parliament works and this kind of thing. And I think it's those sort of extracurricular opportunities to look at the way institutions work. I'm not saying, and I hope I don't come across, that I think you should just, that the Chinese should just simply copy the British regulatory system or institutional system, which I wouldn't on the whole recommend, because it's been built up organically and somewhat mysteriously over many years. But nonetheless, to look at the way in which political and economic and regulatory issues are dealt with in a more transparent environment, I think is something that I would recommend you had a good close look at, because I suspect that that is going to be the environment in which China's, in which you'll be living in the future.
Let me just echo Howard's point on that. When China acceded to the World Trade Organization, there were always a lot of speculation about how much international law would say, in fact, affect China, and what's actually, say, enforceable. And actually, the one thing which is enforceable under international law in this area is transparency of laws and regulations. And this is likely to be the area in which the more exposure you might get to what could work elsewhere and bringing it back to China would be very useful. And that, and I hope you've taken notes during Howard's lecture. Okay, we'll take two more questions, I think. You're very fervent hands. I think I'm going to have to go over there just by the distance which it was raised. So so please.
Hi, thank you. Finally. Hi, I'm a Master of Law student doing corporate securities law at LSE. Just a question further on the development of the derivative market in China in the future. Do you see any indication of interest from the Chinese government on the development of hedge funds in particular? And what's your personal opinion about the practicality of developing hedge funds within China? Maybe in the near future, not specifically at this present stage. Thank you.
Well, I think factually I would have to say that I haven't seen any great interest in developing hedge funds at this point. Although I think there are, in fact, Chinese investment companies who may well be operating rather like the way some hedge funds do. I mean, the problem with answering a question always about hedge funds is, I know it sounds boring, but what do you mean exactly by hedge funds? So if you're talking about investment funds who are prepared to adopt long short strategies, etc. I think there are some investment funds in China who are beginning to do that, albeit they don't call themselves hedge funds. But indeed, I think that the way in which it operates in Western countries is really, a hedge fund is almost by definition a non-regulated collective investment scheme. I mean, that's kind of one way of you defining a hedge fund, really. And I think in China there are non-regulated investment funds, or non-regulated in the sense that they don't have capital requirements imposed on them. And so I suspect that there will be what we in the West call hedge funds operating in China. I think the Chinese will be extremely nervous, I hope they will be extremely nervous, about letting them access to retail investors if they are like that, because I think that's the clear, to me, that's the clearest distinction in hedge funds at the moment. They're funds that are basically unregulated and not able to market themselves to retail investors. And I hope the Chinese understand that if you want to let the retail investor in, you really have to have a better regulatory framework around it.
Final question. I think I'm going to have to go with the back row, the gentleman there.
Good evening, sir. I'm Chen Yixiao, a first-year international relations student at LSE. I have a question. To what extent do you think the overseas listing helped to improve the corporate governance in the big four state-owned commercial banks, and especially the management practices at the local branches? Because I think it's very difficult for both the supervisors and the higher authorities within these banks to regulate and supervise the management practices and business decisions at the grassroots level, because many of the problems, such as bad loans, are created at the grassroots levels, at the local branches, which are far away from the central authority, central headquarters.
Yeah.
And another question. Do you see the need for massive privatization in the banking sector in the future and other sectors within the financial industry as a whole? Because state ownership is really one of the most fundamental structural problems that give rise to all these problems. They are all closely linked, I think. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think your questions are both very interesting, actually. On the first one, I rather agree with you. I think that people do exaggerate what a board of independent directors can do, and you're quite right that even if the Bank of China lists or China Construction Bank lists in Hong Kong and has to have some independent directors and one or two overseas people, they are not going to be spending their time going around, you know, the local branches in Chongqing seeing how creditors' appraisals are done. And so that work is really hard work that has to be done by the management and checked up by the regulators locally, etc. What the independent directors can and should be able to do is ensure that minority shareholders are treated reasonably and that there are reasonable dividends and that in the event of trouble they get their fair share, etc. And also they can ask decent questions about what progress is being made to implement credit appraisal techniques, etc. So they can do something, but I agree that just thinking, well, we bring in a few independent directors and everything will be okay is not... Enron had the most wonderful corporate governance structure you could imagine, with a chairman, a chief executive, independent directors, a chair of the audit committee who taught me at Stanford, everything you could possibly want, but it still didn't make any difference. So I think that your point is right. As for your view about state-owned banks, again, one's a prisoner of one's own experience, and my own experience is that state-owned banks are very expensive institutions for the public to own. And they may not look like that, but actually they are very costly because they are very rarely efficient, and the disciplines on them are just not strong enough. And so my bias is certainly in favor of introducing private capital as much as possible. The big problem China's got in this area, however, and I don't have an easy answer to it, is that these institutions are so big that the amount of appetite for owning them, outside, is somewhat limited. I mean, I don't know how many people are champing at the bit to get a piece of Agricultural Bank of China. It's a huge institution. Who's really going to want to take a small stake in that? And I think that might be one thing that China's got to think about some of the ones further down the line, as to whether they could be privatized in one chunk, or whether they need to think about creating a more diverse system where external shareholders might feel that they could take a significant enough stake to have an influence on the business, where on an institution the size of Agricultural Bank of China, you know, who's going to be big enough to take a significant stake in that bank? There's not many people you can think of.
I think we're going to have to conclude there. We've run out of time, but let us thank Howard Davies again for taking his time out. And I understand that the LSE's Chinese Society has something they would like to present to Howard as well before we conclude.